Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The impact of WikiLeaks on the Middle East. One of the most compelling narratives of the whole WikiLeaks document drop is the extent to which Arab governments took certain positions in public and others in private, most famously quietly asking the U.S. to attack Iran. And we've been hearing lots of Americans talk about this, but now we will get the views of Rami Khoury, longtime Lebanese journalist, columnist, and college professor. He is currently director of the Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University in Beirut. Rami, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
You wrote this week, quote, "The most shocking revelation, not a revelation really, as many of us had warned about this for decades, is that Arab governments that have spent hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in buying American and other foreign arms still find themselves totally helpless, vulnerable, and fearful in the face of what they see as growing Iranian power and influence in the region." Want to talk about that?
Sure. I've been talking about it for a couple of decades, and it just keeps getting worse, apparently, with these leaks now. We have a little bit more documentary evidence, even though it's very selective. The information coming out is the view of American diplomats as they interpret things and relay them. Some of what they relay is factual. Some of it is their own interpretation. So we've got to be careful with some of this stuff. But what is striking is the consistency across the region in many Arab countries in these conversations with American diplomats about telling the Americans or the Israelis, you know, come and do something about Iran and or attack their nuclear facilities or something like that. So they've been saying this in private, many Arab leaders, for many years, that they're worried about Iran. And this evidence is really quite shocking because it really revealed several really troubling things from an Arab perspective. A, that the hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars they've spent, I don't know, it's probably a trillion or more on arms, are simply unavailable to them. They can't do anything with them to protect themselves. So there's a monumental, colossal waste of money, which should have been used for building more schools and building more creative cultural centers and all kinds of things. Second of all, they say these things in private to American diplomats, and in public they say different things. So there's a kind of official duplicity, which is really shameful, and you don't need to act like that. I understand there's a certain need for officials to talk and act discreetly, but this kind of blatant double standard and hypocrisy is really uncalled for. And I think the real problem, biggest problem, is that Iran shouldn't be an enemy. Iran should be a close ally of the Arab countries, and like Turkey and Iran are now becoming close. The Arabs and Iran don't have major problems. They have some problems. There's a few islands that Iran occupies in the Gulf that Arab countries claim. There's some historical animosity. There's some Shia Sunni theological tensions, but all of this stuff is resolvable. And the Arab leaderships and the Iranian leaderships have not made a serious effort to really resolve their political feuds and become major trading partners, transfers of technology between them, joint security agreements in the region. I mean, they should have done this years ago, but they didn't. And so I think on all these levels, this is really pretty shocking.
To follow up on that, how would you characterize the relationship between Iran and Arab nations generally? Most Americans probably have never given that question a thought and probably just, you know, casually see them as aligned against Israel or complex relationships with the United States in the Arab countries' cases. How would you characterize the relationship between Iran and Arab nations generally?
Well, it's rather complex, like most things in the Middle East, and there isn't a simple one answer fits all. I would say, broadly speaking, that most Arab governments are fearful of Iran. They don't like Iranian policy, not because they think Iran's going to attack them or anything like that. They don't like the fact that Iran, after its Islamic revolution that overthrew the Shah, meddled and worked closely in Arab countries with Arab movements like Hezbollah or Hamas recently, and Islamic Brothers and others, to really kind of foment political, whatever we call it, ferment or activism or whatever. Arab governments don't like their citizens using Islam as a means to challenge the exercise of power. And that's really what Arab governments are concerned about, that Iran can activate movements within the Arab countries that are potentially a threat to Arab regimes. But that can be dealt with politically, and it wasn't dealt with. I would say at the level of popular public opinion, it's probably split. I would say a small majority across the region of ordinary Arab men and women look favorably on Iran. They like the way that it defies the U.S. and the West. They like the way it badmouths Israel. They like the way it stands up to the Security Council sanctions. A lot of people like that. But many people in the Arab world also don't like Iran. What it represents is a theological government, the way they put restrictions on certain aspects of women's dress and behavior, the way they've turned into an autocratic regime now. There's serious criticisms of Iran among Arab public opinion, but also a lot of respect and, I think, esteem. So it's very mixed. It's a very mixed situation.
Listeners, we can take some phone calls for Rami Khoury of the American University in Beirut on the impact of WikiLeaks in the Middle East. We would love to hear from some of our Arab American listeners calling in and reacting to what Rami is saying, or just sharing your own thoughts on the Arab world as exposed in part by some of these cables. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Israeli American listeners, Jewish American listeners with an interest in the Middle East, anybody may call, but certainly we would love to hear from some Arab Americans on some of the Arab-oriented revelations in the WikiLeaks documents. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Rami, do you think the publication of these leaks could spark change in the Arab world, popular ferment, peaceful or even otherwise, against some of these, you know, autocratic governments or anything else?
No, I don't think so. The Arab governments and regimes and the political systems are very strong. They are very good at staying in power. Incumbency, I mean, if there was a Nobel Prize for incumbency and longevity, the Arabs would sweep the boards every year. I mean, the Arab leaders, some of them have been there 30, 40 years. You know, Gaddafi in Libya has been there for 40 years. The leaders of Egypt, of Yemen, of Tunisia. And these are not monarchies. These are republics. The monarchs are a different game because monarchy is hereditary. But these are republics, and they've been there or passed on power to their sons for sometimes 20, 30, 40 years. So these governments know how to stay in power, and they know when to loosen up and when to tighten up. So I don't think this will have any major impact. What it will do is just add another little drop of criticism and hopefully more public discussion of these issues. But unfortunately, our political systems in the Arab world are pretty impervious to serious change or any really credible accountability. But people are pushing. People keep pushing. And that's why I wrote this article, because I think these are really important issues that have to be, the change has to come from within.
You wrote in your article this week, it is worse that the Arab leaders who look to the U.S. and Israel to protect them by attacking Iran ask for this course of action quietly, surreptitiously, without standing up for their positions in public. Now, all governments say one thing and do another on many occasions. Do you find it fundamentally worse than usual in this case?
I think it is worse than usual because you're dealing with such a core waste of resources and money and potential. I mean, if the Arab countries, if the Arabs are going to depend on the U.S. and Israel to protect them, then why do they waste $1 trillion or more on armaments that they can't really use, or they use in many cases against their own people or other Arabs? I mean, this is what really bothers me, that this is such an enormous waste of money and human resources. I don't have a problem if Arab governments say, look, we're protectorates of the United States and Israel is our ally. Some Arab governments like Egypt and and Jordan have peace agreements with Israel. That's their choice. They can do that if they want. But what they shouldn't do is play games with their own people and hide their real policies or their real sentiments from their own people. Now, I know politicians do that. I mean, you have to be a little bit duplicitous to be a successful politician, but I think this takes it to a level of such enormous waste that it clarifies, I think, the core problem in the Arab world and why there isn't a single credible democratic system in our region, which is that these countries and these systems are so impervious to change. And it's fascinating to see in the leaks. I think there was, I don't remember seeing anything about Americans pushing for democratic change or, asking these leaders to be more democratic and be more accountable. So this is really the core problem. All the other problems in the Arab world, corruption, war and peace, tension, extremism, all of them emanate from the core foundational dilemma that there is no consent of the governed. The governed do not have to give their consent to the policies of their leaders. Now, the leaders have done some fine things. They've built a lot of schools. They've built a lot of roads. They've created jobs. They've done many good things over the last 50, 60 years. They're not evil people. They're just non-democratic people. And non-democratic people will end up abusing power and wasting a lot of their people's resources. So that adjustment has to take place at some stage in some country. At some point, there will be somebody who starts a process that actually holds power accountable to the consent of the governed.
Let's take a phone call for Rami Khoury, and it's Hamed in Queens. You're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
Yes,
you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to say that, you know, I am from Cairo, and basically we are very poor, and the America gives Egypt $3.5 billion a year to a very corrupt regime. And the WikiLeaks reveals that basically they are corrupt. They say one thing and they do another. And why is America supporting Mubarak with his phony elections? And it's an outrage. America is funding Arab outrage by supporting Egypt and Israel and the treatment of Palestinians. You know that?
Rami, thank you for your call. Rami, what do you want to react to there? There was just the election, a parliamentary election in Egypt, but preceding a presidential election next year that nobody really expects to be honest in terms of real opposition to Mubarak being allowed. And yet the U.S. continues to give Egypt as well as Israel more foreign aid than any other country.
Right. I think these, what happened in Egypt are not really elections. What happened in Egypt was a kind of a show, which could have had some credibility years ago, but in its present form doesn't. And this is part of the problem in the region. And everybody knows these elections are not serious. You get 20-30% turnout. People know what the vote, the results are going to be pretty much ahead of time. And this goes on. And the foreign supporters of these Arab governments tend not to do much about it. The people of the region can't do very much about it. And change doesn't seem to come from within these systems, as it did, say, in Gorbachev's Russia, where the people in power realized that their days were numbered and started a process of change. Or F.W. de Klerk in South Africa. The leaders, courageous, honest leaders, real leaders, real statesmen and women, see the reality of historical inevitability and move with the times to serve their people. This isn't happening in the Arab world. So the comments of Hamed are very typical of people all over the region. But there's a frustration that they can't do anything about it. And therefore, a lot of people leave. They emigrate. They go to other countries. Or some of them turn to radical movements. Some of them turn to criminality. And it's a very corrosive process when the integrity and the dignity and the credibility and the efficacy of public policy mechanisms, government systems, when these start to degrade and erode from within, the whole system starts to squeak and then to reek with inefficiency and corruption and waste. And this is the problem that we're getting all over the world. How it will be solved is hard to predict, but we just see it going on and on and on, and these WikiLeaks just make a little bit more evident what most people already know and feel angry about.
We're talking about the impact of WikiLeaks on the Middle East with Rami Khoury, director of the Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut, and Ibrahim in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. As a Yemeni, I'm actually reading the news and the media and what they're saying about this issue of WikiLeaks. To be honest, they actually expose the corrupted governments that actually, let's put it this way, people who is basically misleading in somehow the United States and its diplomatic on the Middle East by asking money and by all of these things that actually don't make sense on the ground and doesn't help a lot. I'm not with any problems that WikiLeaks may create between Arabs, Iran, between Arabs and Israel, but it's basically and actually revealed and exposed these actually regimes and these people and their reality, which create a lot of interesting things among the media, among people. And it looks like people back there, they look at it as scandal. And they make a lot of even joke and fun about it, too.
Do you think, Ibrahim, do you think that in Yemen there might be any fallout from what was the headline revelation from WikiLeaks about Yemen, which is that they let the U.S. stage a particular attack inside Yemen, an assassination that the Yemeni government itself took responsibility for, basically covering for the United States?
That actually revealed what the government sometimes say, well, we are protecting, we are against, and behind the scene there, it's the opposite. But a lot of things, people didn't talk about it, about this case in particular. Yes, they went over it, but the main things actually is behind the corruption that's going on and taking money and exchanging, money for something that's not happening on ground.
Thank you very much for your call. Rami, what about some of what we learned about Israel in these leaks? Like Netanyahu, shortly before he became prime minister, saying he doesn't want to govern the West Bank and would be open to land swaps, meaning taking some land from Jewish settlers, something he hasn't said publicly, I don't believe, or the head of Mossad being quoted very critically about the head of Qatar and saying that, you know, they support Al Jazeera, which is based there, and that Al Jazeera could prompt the next war in the Middle East. Any reactions to these things?
Well, you've got to, you know, Netanyahu is a very slippery character, and that's how he's seen in Israel. Even people who vote for him say that. And, you know, when he says something like, I want to get out of parts of the West Bank, of course, he probably means he wants to get out of around 50%, and he doesn't want to give it all back, and he wants to control the underground water and the air above it and the borders. And so you're talking about an apartheid type, a Bantustan type system that the right wing in Likud and Israel would see as something that they could live with. He doesn't spell it out. He just makes these generalities. And that's why Israeli leaders say, we are ready for peace, we are ready for compromise, but they never give you the details. When they get down to negotiating the details, what they come up with is well short of what is generally seen as the international consensus of full withdrawal for full peace, which is what they did with Jordan and Egypt. I mean, Israel is capable of a reasonable peace agreement that's fair to both sides. They just don't seem to be able to do it with the Palestinians. And this is why this Arab-Israeli conflict has gone on for so long. It's the core conflict between Zionism, which wants a Jewish state, and Palestinian Arab rights, which want to have a Palestinian Arab sovereign state. And even side by side now, we accept to live side by side with Israel in an Arab state. But Zionism has a problem with that, and Netanyahu, I think, represents that problem. They have to work it out through negotiations. There are a lot of very reasonable people in Israel, and hopefully they will make their views known, but that is not the case right now with a very right-wing government. The Israeli views about Arab leaders are often done in the abstract, where there's not a lot of contact between them. What they say is often ideologically driven by domestic Israeli politics. So I wouldn't put a lot of credence about what Israeli security people say about different Arab leaders.
And I don't want to get into a whole back and forth about the Arab-Israeli conflict. I'll just acknowledge that I'm sure some people were offended by the use of the term apartheid or Bantustan state, and just leave that acknowledgement there and take a phone call from Jake in Brooklyn for Rami Khoury. Jake, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, how are you, Brian?
Okay.
Good morning. First off, I appreciate your comment about listeners taking umbrage at the apartheid comment. I won't comment on that, but umbrage was taken. Secondly, I'd like your host to, I'd like your guest to maybe comment on, he had mentioned something in passing in the beginning that Arab leaders were looking to Israel to do something on Iran, and I just wanted more elaboration on that. Is it really that Arab leaders are kind of secretly asking Israel to help them with Iran? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you for your call. Did you take that from these WikiLeaks documents, Rami?
If I ended the phone line, wasn't very clear that that some of the Arab leaders.
Yes,
like
we're not
Israel.
Just asking the U.S. to take action against Iran, but asking quietly asking Israel, or asking that Israel take military action against Iran.
Yeah, yeah, I think that came through. If they were not asking, they were certainly acquiescing and saying, look, if Israel is going to do something, do it quickly, or if the U.S. or Israel. So they see, many people in the Arab world see the U.S. and Israel as sort of one entity. And certainly on the Iranian issue, Israel is a great driver of this process. The Americans have their concerns, and so do Europeans, but Israel is pushing this very, very hard. And therefore, people, some of the Arab leaders were quoted as more or less expecting Israel and the U.S. to do something. But just to note, Brian, about what you said, of course, some people will be offended when we use terms like apartheid or Bantustan, but this is an opinion. I mean, you know, the greatness of the United States is that all views are given a chance to be aired, and the counter views are heard as well. And so I think it's really important to discuss these issues and to talk about the different views on both sides. This debate goes on in Israel, but it doesn't go on in the United States. This is the real dilemma, I think, in the United States. It's a media problem. It's a political public politics problem. Why is there a more vibrant debate in Israel than there is in the United States? So I think it's really important to hear the views of all sides. And I know I welcome hearing Israeli and Zionist views, and to bring these issues out into the public and talk about them in a factual, calm, serious way, which is why your program is so good, because you give people a chance to talk and you hear different views. But there shouldn't be a silencing of reasonable opinion. I think when people raise issues and use words like apartheid or Bantustans, they're giving a view, they're giving an opinion. When Americans give these views, when Sarah Palin and Democrats give these views, they use very strong language. But why is it not used so much in the Arab-Israeli conflict? I think this is a real moral and a professional journalistic dilemma that Americans have to address more vigorously.
And we will let that stand as the last word. Rami Khoury, Director of the Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. Last word, except that, Rami, as you know, we've invited you to contribute to the 2010 Brian Lehrer Show guest gift guide. So if you feel like telling us what holiday you celebrate at this time of year, you can, or if not, just what gift you're giving.
Well, I'm a Greek Orthodox Christian from Nazareth, so I'm sort of the granddaddy of Christianity. And of course, Khoury means priest. It's the same as Cohen for Jews, which means priest. So being a priest from Nazareth is about as Christian as you can get. And we celebrate Christmas, and we celebrate all the monotheistic religions and the joys that Jews and Muslims and Christians all have in their heart at these occasions. But in terms of gifts, I'm actually really impressed by these electronic readers. My wife recently brought me a Kindle as a gift, and this thing is extraordinary, what it allows people to do, or any of the other readers that other companies produce. So I'm probably going to give a couple of those as gifts to people, and the amount of information that you can get, and of course the entertainment. I mean, I spend a lot of time on my iPod and my Kindle listening to rock concerts, reading newspapers, and writing stuff. So these, to me, are an amazing development, and it's one of the reasons why we in the Arab world love American cultural values, because you produce things like the Kindle.
Well, we went in 1 minute's time from the legitimacy of the term apartheid in the Middle East debate to Kindle of Nazareth. So, Rami Khoury, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up tomorrow, we will conclude our week-long coverage of the WikiLeaks cables by asking, who is Julian Assange anyway, and what does he really want? That's coming up tomorrow here on The Brian Lehrer Show. And coming up in just a minute, we continue our December economy series, Rut or Recovery, with your calls on local government services. How has the downturn affected your schools, your streets, and more? Where are they still in decline, and where are they coming back? Stay with us for that. Bob Henley will join us.